Welcome back to the Reverse Brain Disorder Summit, where this is all about better brain health. Joining me now is my good friend and my own practitioner, Kyle Kosunos. Kyle graduated from San Diego State University with his bachelor's in kinesiology in 2010 and earned his doctorate in physical therapy from the University of Miami in 2014. Kyle specializes in a manual medicine approach called counterstrain and earned his strain and counterstrain certification from the Jones Institute in 2017. 10 years ago, he took his first counterstrain course and quickly realized the power of this technique through the successful treatment of his patients' symptoms and alleviation of pain they experienced. Kyle believes in the power of manual therapy and approaches his patients' pain by understanding the relevant anatomy, its blood supply, its drainage, and its innervation from the nervous system. The counterstrain approach allows him to diagnose and treat the major systems of the body that are causing pain, dysfunction, and dysregulation. Kyle, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, we've chatted a number of times. Of course, I come and see you as often as I can. Your schedule is quite busy. In fact, right before this call, I had to book another appointment for a few months out because that's when you're next available. So I love to see that counterstrain is catching on. And yet it's still a therapy, a technique that I find almost everybody I talk to has never heard of. And so it's really fascinating in the sense that it's still very new in the public perception. And yet it's been around for quite a while from your guys' perspective. I mean, decades at least. And yet it's still evolving and it's growing very rapidly. So maybe just give people an introduction to kind of the history of counterstrain. Where did it come from? And kind of what is it about?
Sure. Yeah. Counterstrain's an osteopathic manual medicine technique. There's really two stories that need to be told in regards to its origin. So the original developer of the technique was an osteopath. His name was Dr. Lawrence Jones. So he passed away in the late 90s. But in 1955, he had a patient that came in for psoasitis, back pain that was hunched over, that couldn't stand up straight. And that patient had been manipulated by multiple chiropractors. And even Dr. Jones, who at the time was a manipulator, tried to do HVLAs or high velocity manipulations to the patient's low back, and failed to give that patient the relief that he was looking for. So one day the patient came in and said, if you could just help me find a comfortable position to sleep in, I think I can then start to like at least feel a little bit better, have some more energy, start to heal. So Dr. Jones went with that idea and he laid the patient down and flexed his legs up, side bent him 60 degrees this way, rotated him 60 degrees that way. And the patient kind of stopped him at one point and said, I'm comfortable right now. I don't feel the pain. So Dr. Jones left him there, said, I'll be back in 20. I'm going to go see another patient. Went and saw the other patient, came back to see the psoasitis patient, and he was asleep. So Dr. Jones kind of gently woke him up and helped him stand up. And the patient stood up straight for the first time, pain-free. In months, right? So that was like the light bulb that went off in Dr. Jones's mind that there's spontaneous release from passive position. From there, it took him about 40 plus years to put together over 200 or so techniques and to start to find these diagnostic tender points that he could use to not only diagnose the dysfunctions that he needed to treat, but also to assess whether or not his release was effective. So that's the first story. The second story comes probably in the late 90s as well. One of Dr. Jones's original instructors, Brian Tuckey, who's a physical therapist out in Maryland and the developer of fascial counterstrain, was working on a patient and couldn't relieve that patient's rib pain. And so he had taken a number of visceral release courses. And he was using those techniques, but he was using them in a direct way, which is assessing a barrier and then trying to push through that barrier.
And this is pretty common, right? It's like, let's find where the body's resisting, where something is catching, right? And then let's figure out how to move that body through that pain point, that sticking point, right? That's a fairly common sort of approach mentally, right?
Yeah, direct tissue manipulation is probably what most people have heard of and are aware of, right? So if there's a restriction in a joint, mobilize through it or manipulate through it. Or if that muscle's tight at that point, try and stretch a little bit further, right? So those are all examples of direct releases. So Brian was using those on visceral tissue, or visceral being an umbrella term for internal organs. But he was a counterstrainer in the musculoskeletal world. So kind of a light bulb went off in his head there. Why don't I try and do an indirect tissue manipulation or counterstrain manipulation to this liver? And he did, and immediately felt this massive kind of a liver release. And then when he went back and reassessed the restriction that he felt, it was gone. Patient stood up. That rib pain was gone that the patient was experiencing. And so that was the initial discovery for Brian, to where he was like, I know I can counterstrain musculoskeletal because we've been doing that with strain and counterstrain. Now I just figured out I can manipulate the visceral fascia. What can't we counterstrain? And that sent him off on this long journey that he's still currently on, where he basically made a spreadsheet of all the anatomical structures in the body and started just knocking them out as far as this is how we release it. This is where the correlating tender point is. And like I said, he's still going. And what makes what he's doing now so cool with this topic is now he's in the brain. And he's pushing the envelope as far as mechanical release to neural and vascular structures of the central nervous system.
Well, and this is if I haven't said it already, this is one of the most profound and effective therapies and techniques that I've come across. Being in sort of this integrative health world, I kind of pride myself on investigating as much as I can, whether it's indigenous medicine techniques and ancient healing arts, and of course the modern science. And this is one that when I came across it, I was pretty perplexed by, to be honest. Again, studying a lot of anatomy, studying a lot of physiology, I have a decent grasp on what's going on in the body. And when I talked to you, Kyle, like you just kind of blew me out of the water with your knowledge, and not only the knowledge, not only the sort of book smarts about the biology, that's the internal biology, but the experiential aspect to what you do. And so that caught my attention, right? When I'm sitting in your office and you're just speaking over my head when it comes to how the body is working internally, and all the various microstructures that go on all this on all these levels, I ended up being the student in that regard, to a profound degree, and not only from asking you a million questions, but also experiencing it directly. And that's where, again, I was kind of opened up to a totally new healing art. And just to kind of describe it for those listening, from my rookie perspective, somebody who didn't really know what this was, I'm laying on a table, and Kyle starts kind of feeling my skull, right? And he's looking for these tender points that he was talking about, and he's got this very keen sense of awareness with regard to touch and how these tender points are showing up in the skull. And then once he finds one, and of course he's able to find it just by his own feel, but he actually locates it for me. So I'm walking in, I don't feel like anything's tender on my head, and he finds this tiny little point here, and he pushes on it just a little bit, and I'm like, whoa, like, what's that? Why is that tender? And so he'd find these tender points, and then that's correlated somehow, again, to my untrained patient perspective, somehow it's correlated to, my liver and some channel that's running up, right? And all these different things, right? And to the point where I'm just like, I don't understand what's happening here. But he finds that something is blocked, something's not functioning correctly. And then if I'm just gonna sort of make something up here, but something's blocked in sort of some liver channel, and he's manipulating my left knee, right? Like, and putting it over my right hip and holding it there for 30 seconds, and it's very comfortable and soft and easy. Then he puts it back and checks the tender point on my head again, and it's not tender anymore, and the channel's now opened. And this is what was happening, right? And of course, I'm oversimplifying and getting it way wrong, but that's really kind of, yeah, he laughs. But that's kind of what was happening, right? And to me, that it didn't make any logical sense, right? To the untrained person and to how most of us think linearly about the body, it didn't make any sense, right? And again, I have a little familiarity with Chinese medicine and Ayurveda, so I'm familiar with things not connecting directly to our sort of intuitive perspective. But this is what was happening. So Kyle, kind of fill in the gaps, and let me know, let the audience know kind of what's really going on that level, how you're able to do something like that.
Well, I mean, it's funny hearing you talk about it, because most people from like an intuitive level are actually pretty in tune when it comes to the musculoskeletal system.
Right.
What they lack the basic concept of is that the body's nervous system and arterial system and venous lymphatic system also have jobs to do.
Right.
And they're also responsive to stress and to trauma. And when they do, they can become if a dysfunction develops in those tissues, they can become inefficient at doing their jobs. Right. And from a basic physiology standpoint, the artery's jobs is to supply blood and oxygen to a tissue.
Into the whole body, right? Like
into
this
the
is
whole, into every tissue.
Everything, right?
Into every tissue.
Yeah.
And we know it's not uncommon knowledge that arteries vasospasm. And when they do, the velocity of blood traveling through that artery changes. They, you know, scientists can measure that. And they measure it in the brain in the circle of Willis. So if an artery becomes inefficient at supplying blood and oxygen to a tissue, that tissue is going to fail. Maybe not immediately. Maybe it'll start to degenerate, but it's going to be weak. I always tell my patients blood flow to a tissue is like putting gas in a car. Tissue just does not go without oxygen.
And the other part to that is that that tissue is now not functioning optimally, right, for
Correct.
Some period of time. And lest we forget that that tissue is either directly or indirectly connected to the entire body itself, right? So it's sure. not like it stops there, right? So this is how we, this is the downward spiral of ill health that we can get caught in, right?
Right, so the artery is not functioning well. The tissue that it's supposed to supply blood to is not functioning well. It's not capable of optimal healing. It's not capable, if we're talking about a muscle, let's say, it's not capable of an optimal contraction. So it may present as weak. And then it also, in this state, it's more likely to break down. Whether it's to be torn, to develop a tendonitis, to develop an arthritis in regards to joints, or for organs to break down if they're not supplying, getting that healthy supply of oxygen and nutrition from the arterial supply. That's just one side of the capillary bed. We haven't even talked about the venous lymphatic yet, which is probably one of the more powerful ones because it removes chemical waste.
Right? And tell people why you sort of lump that together, why it's a venous lymphatic, why it's always together in that way.
Lymphatics span the entire body. There are certain areas of the body where there's a higher accumulation, but they travel with veins. So a lot of times when we treat the veins, we're getting lymphatics as well. But in regards to like reabsorption of deoxygenated blood, veins reabsorb about 85%. The venous lymphatic system is responsible for about 15%. But the other thing that the venous lymphatic system does is reabsorbs interstitial fluid. And that interstitial fluid is interstitial space that contains the fluid is everywhere in the body. It's in all of our tissues. And it is an area that's microscopic, right? It takes like high level imaging to be able to see. And it's where a lot of stuff gets stuck. A lot of congestion occurs. And therefore chemical waste that sits in that tissue that pisses off our proprioceptors and our peripheral neurons in the area, and then resultant nociceptive protective muscle guarding occurs because of that.
Protective muscle guarding, it's an interesting concept and I'm very familiar with it experientially, but maybe explain that one a little bit.
Yeah, so that's really a lot of what we as counter trainers use to diagnose dysfunctions in deeper systems. So, you know, there could be a protective muscle guarding spasm of something as large as your popliteus muscle, which is a muscle in the back of the knee, or as small as an intercostal muscle that locks up a joint in a very specific location. But every neural, vascular, visceral, musculoskeletal structure that we have in the body, when the peripheral neurons and proprioceptors that are within it are pissed off from a chemical stress or mechanical trauma, they have this reflex arc that excites a nociceptive reflex or a muscle guarding protective spasm. So basically, any dysfunction anywhere in the body, you're going to feel it, right? And it might not reach threshold to where you're aware of it, but us as counter strainers, we can find that muscle guarding spasm and elicit it with palpation.
Well, and this is what most of us that had dealt with pain or dealing with pain, we notice it when it gets to that high threshold, right? In other words, I move my shoulder here and it starts to hurt, and therefore I can't really move it any farther, even if I try sometimes, right? And it's sort of it's the protective aspect of the body saying, hey, there's a lot of inflammation and pain going on in there. It's not a good idea. Like the body's sort of talking to us saying, hey, it's
hell, you don't go back there.
Right. Yeah. And so there's something going on there. And that's how we sort of deal with pain. But on a micro level, that may be happening in our hips, in our psoas, in our back, all over the place, to the point where we're losing mobility, we're losing function, and we don't even realize it yet. And I can, you know, if any, I see this a lot when I go to yoga class, right? And some of these older guys like myself, we show up and we literally don't have the mobility and flexibility in some of these things that I see these younger kids have, particularly the women. And it's really interesting to note that At one point we did, and I know that because I can watch my 2-year-old son and he can move everywhere. Now there's joint space and there's all kinds of other things going on there. However, there's also these dysfunctions that start to show up as we get older and as we sort of acquire more dysfunction throughout our lives. And one of the things that's fascinating when I've experienced counter strain is that as you manipulate, mobility increases, pain goes away, right? I've experienced anything from detox reactions. So in other words, things start to move again, right? And toxins and chemicals and metabolic waste that was stuck in the system is now moving through at a pretty rapid rate. And then I've experienced the opposite too after a session, which is inflammatory symptoms, whatever they might be, seem to decrease, right? So they were stuck in the system and causing inflammation. Now they're actually being flushed out, right? So there's very fascinating results that can come from this. I want to center this around the brain and brain health because this is one of those things that, although actually, before we get there, though, I would love for you to address this idea that you can sort of feel the skull and detect these pain points and then correlate that with the body and systems that are maybe dysfunctioning, because there's probably some doubters or disbelievers that are watching this, or even those who are just curious on how that's possible. What is it, the mechanism that you can correlate and tie that together?
Yeah, so what you're referring to is one of the main diagnostic tools that we have in fascial counter strain that Brian Tuckey's developed. I refer to it as the most powerful gift that he's given manual practitioners. Because the fact that he's mapped it out the way that he has is amazing. It's
That's
remarkable.
wild.
From there, if you know your anatomy and you have palpation skills and you do indirect manipulation, there's nothing that you can't release. There's no anatomical structure that you can't treat. But the cranial scan is essentially a cranial mobility test of the cranial bones that tells us what to treat and where to treat it. In addition to that, it also prioritizes for us based on severity of restriction and severity of pain that the patient might feel.
Sorry, there's a hierarchy of symptoms too, right? So that's what's interesting. And sorry to derail you, but it came to mind that you seem to be able to determine, okay, this system is maybe the most important thing to deal with right now, and there may be systems under that after we release this and get this moving that we can pick up on. So maybe just tie that into your conversation because that's a really fascinating aspect that many, many diagnostic tools cannot pick up.
The scan or the cranial mobility test allows me to assess what system is dysfunctional, most dysfunctional in the body, and then also where. And there are times that when I'm doing a scan where multiple systems and/or regions of the body will appear positive. But the scan is also dynamic. Right. So let's say we're in working with you, I find rigidity in the occipital bone, and that tells me that your preganglionic sympathetic nervous systems from T5 to T1 are dysfunctional and need to be treated. I'll then go into the body and find the tender points that correlate to the rigidity that I found in the head, treat those dysfunctions, come back up to the head, and that rigidity's improved, right? And then I'll kind of rescan, recheck all of my different regions of the cranium, and find that, all right, now this one is the next most positive. Whereas before, it might not have been positive at all. So
Right.
the body does this, and we have some other tools, some different like inhibition and things like that we use to help sequence. But the body kind of always prioritizes the next worst thing. And part of what makes counter strain a technique with such great carryover, meaning we can do a handful of releases in a given treatment, and the next time you come in, those treatments I should not have to redo, is because we can sequence so well with the cranial scan.
Yeah, it's almost like it's like you address the high needs in this session. And if I were to come back to you next week, it's almost like I wouldn't say we're hoping for new things to show up, but it's almost like we're kind of expecting something else to show up now because the body's now rebalanced. And in essence, we kind of want the next things to start to show up so we can address those, right? So like that's what's interesting. It's not like chiropractic where, I've got a problem area and we need kind of to focus on this adjustment, whether it be continual kind of adjustments or this progression. You know, I know there's a lot of different kind of chiropractic adjustment models, so I don't want to pigeonhole that. And there is a way forward, but it tends to be kind of the same, addressing the same aspects of the body. Whereas this, we're starting to move through the symptoms, move through the hierarchy of imbalances, to the point where we find a new equilibrium. And of course, as we live life, we get out of balance on a continual basis. Things get blocked and things get, you know, experience some dysfunction. But that's what I find so fascinating, is that we can move through the hierarchical symptoms and the body is dynamically finding a new center.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the other dynamic part of that is the patient themselves, right? So
totally.
I'll create a series of releases that changes that patient's homeostasis. And then over the next week, let's say before I see them again, their body, their normal physiology is going to occur, right? So they're going to come back a different patient for the beginning of visit two than they were at the end of visit one.
Right. Yeah. So getting into sort of brain health and some of the things that you notice when patients walk through the door, I mean, first of all, a lot of what you're addressing is, of course, all the systems, but the nervous system being a key system that you're addressing. And so that being very tied into to brain health. What do you notice when it comes to, you know, because we've got a conventional view of things like dementia and Alzheimer's and cognitive decline and chronic fatigue and all these sort of like nervous system, brain, gut, you know, kind of detox systems. And then we have got an integrative perspective on these things, which is maybe a little bit more elaborate, a little bit more, of course, integrative and inclusive of a lot of different systems. And then I think you probably carry a unique perspective, and I haven't talked to you about this. I'm really curious what it is that you're picking up just through your own experience based on the patients that walk through the door when it comes to nervous system dysfunctions, brain dysfunction, you know, foggy thinking, you know, sleep issues, the standard stuff that we might see.
I would say over the past even 6 months or so, my patient caseload has pretty dramatically shifted towards patients with central nervous system symptoms, whether it's sleep issues, brain fog, post-concussion, post-stroke, post-TBI. So I had always been kind of working my way that way. And that's been, you know, the track of fascial counterstrain that Brian's been taking us all on. But I would say the approach to treating the central nervous system for me right now isn't really all that different from my approach to, you know, treating someone with moderate knee OA. And that, and you kind of said it in my bio, the paradigm is that we want is applied anatomy. So we want to take a look at the very specific areas of the brain that may be affected, whether it's, you know, brainstem, diencephalon with the thalamus and the hypothalamus, areas of the cerebral cortex. But we want to take a look at those specific areas of the brain. We want to take a look at the veins that are responsible for draining those areas of the brain, and then the arteries that are responsible for supplying blood to it. Which are capable of vasospasm, just like arteries and veins in the rest of the body. And we want to restore normal perfusion to that area of the brain.
So this seems to be a big part of it, right? Like when let's just take, you know, concussions or traumatic brain injuries of any kind, right? My firm belief is that the body is capable. Let me put it this way. The body has the wisdom and the intelligence to recover, to heal, right? And yet, the sort of opposition to that argument is, well, sometimes it just doesn't, right? So there's something blocking this wisdom from expressing, this intelligence from expressing health, right? So from your perspective, what are some of those things? I mean, of course, we've been naming sort of the venous lymphatic system and what have you, but how are these things preventing us from fully recovering when we deal with something like traumatic brain injury or concussion or anything like that?
Well, perfusion is going to be the big one. Okay. Perfusion, and then on the, you know, venous lymphatic side of the capillary bed there, it's going to be congestion and inflammation. Tissue that's congested and inflamed is just not going to heal because there's no room for oxygen and nutrition to get in via the arterial system. So that's going to be the main way, but that's impacted by so many different things. We can have intrinsic vasospasm of the venous lymphatic vessels or of the arterial vessels. But those vessels are also innervated by the autonomic nervous system. So like one kind of protocol, for lack of a better word, for treating anyone with cranial symptoms is treating the preganglionic sympathetics and postganglionic sympathetic nerves that originate from the spinal cord, T1, T2 primarily, and then come up the cervical spine of the anterior neck through this cervical sympathetic chain. They synapse at various ganglia there, and then we have postganglionics that come up into the brain via the vertebral artery and the internal carotid artery and innervate all the vessels. And if we're in a elevated state of sympathetic arousal, we get vasospasm of those vessels. The dysfunctions.
Yes. Yeah, so I just want to recap that for maybe those who aren't quite understanding the technical speak. So the nervous system is coming into the brain, and that nervous system that may be caught in this fight or flight response on a continual basis, which is good for inflammation and for a lot of things, but if it's chronically stuck on, and those nerves can't tip over into the parasympathetic state that allow for detoxification and removal of things and healing, then that's kind of what's getting us in trouble. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, the way that I talk about the sympathetic nervous system is that it is, in recognizable terms, it's the fight or flight aspect of the nervous system. So when we're either running for our life or fighting for our life, we're in this elevated sympathetic state. It is a protective, reflexive state that we go into when we need it. In that state, our body, our central nervous system, only cares about surviving that moment.
Right.
And then as soon as that moment passes, it only cares about surviving that next moment. And then that next moment. In that state, your body can't possibly be in a good state for longevity, right? So, one of our main goals, and I do this with almost every patient that I have that has central nervous system symptoms or chronic pain, is I have to get their sympathetic state depressed, or not depressed, but balanced, right? We have to find that homeostasis between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system by removing the dysfunction within the pre and postganglionic sympathetic nerves.
And so with your sort of counterstrain manipulation, right? And this is not moving through something, right? It's some other part of the body. So give me an example of what you might adjust or manipulate, necessarily not adjust, when it comes to those preganglionic cells.
Yeah, so we have from the T1, T2 level of the spinal cord, our sympathetic nervous system originates from T1 all the way down to L2. Predominantly, the fibers that come up into the neck and then eventually up into the cranial cavity come from T1, T2. And they travel up this little neural structure that comes right up the anterior aspect of the neck. So we have counterstrain tender points along the clavicle and the manubrium that would let us know that those tissues are dysfunctional. So we would assess or diagnose the need to treat those there. And then we would monitor those regions of the body for a successful release. The way we release that one is with a simple position or slackening or indirect tissue manipulation. So the nerves travel from here and they come up, very generally speaking. So we position the head and the neck in this kind of flexed side bend toward and rotated position in order to take the mechanical strain out of that tissue, drain the interstitial fluid off of it that's kind of keeping it congested and therefore in this elevated state of proprioceptive awareness, and then hold, right? We hold that position for anywhere from 45 to a minute to 90 seconds, usually at most. And that hold is really where the magic happens, because that's what allows the lymphatic system to drain the interstitial fluid off of that tissue.
And this is what's fascinating, right? It's such a simple manipulation, and it's generally pretty comfortable. I mean, you can almost fall asleep in a session. Well, sometimes you can, but it's that holding that somehow is sending mechanical signals. The body's picking up some signals that's allowing it to shift its state. I mean, this is what's fascinating to me. And perhaps you guys know how it works. I don't pretend to know, but it's fascinating to me that just a little bit of manual manipulation like that can create new signals for the body, allow that drainage to happen, right? Which get rid of all those inflammatory cytokines and inflammagens that are in the tissue that are causing both pain and also exacerbating the sort of sympathetic drive, right? And so we're draining those out and preventing from new, fresh, oxygenated, life force, energy-rich chi, blood, oxygen into that tissue, right? I mean, however you describe it, that's where the life force energies and healing energy is going to come from. So we're removing the block, getting fresh, good stuff in there, and that's what allows for the, I guess, progression toward healing, right? I mean, that's totally mind-blowing to me, and I honestly don't know anything like it.
It's so simple in its releases, and it's purely based on anatomy. All we're doing is an indirect tissue manipulation to anatomy. That's it. But it's so specific. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I may put you in a cervical flexed side bent toward rotated toward position. And I could do that general positioning for, let's say, 50 releases. But the single structure that I'm targeting at that point for that technique, for that 45 second hold, is the cervical sympathetic chain, preganglionic sympathetic fibers specifically that run through it. But a very similar release, just again, targeted towards that specific structure and towards that specific tender point, you know, would be for like the common carotid artery or the recurrent branch of the laryngeal nerve, or, you know, the interlongitudinal ligament of the neck. So, the positions are very general, but the technique is very specific as far as what anatomical structure that we're targeting for that specific place.
And what I love too is that, you know, let's say somebody comes in with mild hearing loss or tinnitus, right? Where they got the ringing in their ears, right? Now conventional medicine looks at it that at one way, integrative and functional medicine would look at those things in a different way, or chronic headaches, right? Cluster headaches. These are things that are, I think we can reasonably assess that those are symptoms, right? Like those aren't the problem, they are the symptom. And so trying to suppress them or get them just to go away in any way possible is not really an objective that we would ideally want to follow. And what I find about counterstrain is that it's not necessarily even trying to get rid of the tinnitus, for example. It's just looking for where the dysfunctions are, where the blockages are, what needs to be addressed. And in so doing, these symptoms can just start to go away on their own, right? And again, it's because you're addressing the fundamental blocks, imbalances, and dysfunctions, and the body can reassert itself. It can reset. And so that's what I love. And I'm curious if you would have somebody that comes in with tinnitus or cluster headaches, is that something? Do you guys have a framework that you even look at these sort of symptoms or disease states, so to speak? Do you even address those in any specific way? Or does that give you just an insight as to, okay, I've seen tinnitus before and I generally know kind of what I typically see and I know what to look for, so to speak, in terms of imbalances?
Yeah, diagnoses and pathology certainly give us a framework and they give us like a target, right? So if I just treated and got rid of dysfunctions, but we saw no clinical impact of that, then that would be kind of boring. But the fact that you know, a patient can come in, I can assess them via the cranial scan and via tender points and diagnose or find dysfunction. Depending on how dysfunctional that patient is to me, I can predict whether or not I feel like I'll be able to help that patient.
Yeah, right.
So if they're coming in for migraines, and I find sympathetic nerve dysfunction, I find cervical and cranial vascular dysfunction in the arterial system and the venous lymphatic system, I find dural dysfunction in the cranium and in the spinal cord, then I can reasonably predict if we can successfully get rid of these dysfunctions, then your symptoms theoretically should improve. Anecdotally, they do. So that's what kind of keeps it interesting, is ultimately we're in this position because I love to help people. And I want to help them with whatever ailment they're suffering from at that time, whether it's headaches, brain fog, or some of the more complex kind of central nervous system pathologies that are out there.
Well, and I've actually recently dealt with a bout of mold, toxicity and infection and mycotoxins in my system, and I have some awareness on how to deal with that. And yet I've gone into Kyle and he's noticed that my sort of venous lymphatic system was blocked. It wasn't flowing, it wasn't moving. And so this is one of those examples where I can do some of these lymphatic drainage techniques, right? I can do some massage type of techniques and some dry brushing and some oil massage and other things too, saunas. These will exercise, these will get the lymphatic system going. And still I can be a little bit blocked, right? And so when I come in and I'm doing sort of a detox and I'm trying to clear this mold and mycotoxins out of my system, coming into Kyle and having him open up those channels that are blocked and moving that out ended up being extremely helpful. Now, specifically what I noticed the last time I saw him was that my elbow had a little bit of inflammation, a little bit of pain when I would exercise or work out. And after seeing him the next day, that inflammation was dramatically reduced, right? And so what I chalked that up to was not something wrong with my elbow, so to speak. Now, why it was showing up there, I don't know, but ultimately the inflammatory load that was being put on the elbow due to the various toxins and things in my system were getting blocked and caught in particularly in the elbow, right? And that's where the, and again, it could have been something back in toward my spine, right? And sending peripheral pain to my elbow. It could have been directly in the elbow, right? So I'm trying to point to this idea that there's so much going on in the body that when we feel pain somewhere, it may be as a result of something going on in a different part of the body, right? And so freeing this up and providing relief in the proper way can result in all kinds of symptom relief throughout the body, not necessarily based on where the location of that is.
Yeah, and I think, ultimately, with every counterstrain release that we do, what we're physiologically doing is restoring normal function to the lymphatic pump of the lymphatic pumps that are in that area, because that's what allows the lymphatic system to its own internal intrinsic pumping mechanism to then absorb the interstitial fluid that's housing the chemical waste that's pissing off the tissue. Ultimately, as humans, we kind of bend where we break, or I'm sorry, we break where we bend. So if you're inflamed and you're doing a whole lot of bicep curls, tricep extensions, you're moving a ton at your elbow. That's where you're going to feel it. But your whole body's inflamed, or your whole upper extremity can be inflamed, and the dysfunction, the primary accumulation of it, could be, near your thoracic outlet, let's say, as an example.
I think it was actually, now that you say that, that's what was going on. Yeah, and I think what's fascinating too, and just to kind of give people the sort of the waste removal system, if they're not familiar with it, right? We have this interstitial fluid or cavity, however you want to think about it. In fact, it's actually been classified as an organ recently, right? By the medical system, we said, okay, all this stuff that we thought was kind of blank fluid space, well, it turns out it's kind of its own tissue and it serves its own function, and we can classify it as an organ system. And so that's basically throughout the body in microstructures and large structures, and the fluid is exchanged into the lymphatic system, right, and the venous lymphatic system, and then that is goes eventually into the gut, right? And we get that into the gut, or we sweat that out. This is how we get rid of a lot of waste, right? We breathe it out too, but a lot the idea, and this is what Ayurveda, there's a couple techniques in the Panchakarma system to get all that metabolic waste, all that crap into the lymphatic system, into the blood, into the gut eventually, so we can excrete this stuff, right? So it's a really, really integral part of waste removal is that interstitial fluid and lymphatic system. And so when that gets blocked and backed up, that sets us up for a lot of long-term issues. And not just in sort of the body, but the brain, right? In fact, the brain has its own sort of lymphatic system that we've termed the glymphatic system. So maybe talk to me a little bit about that anatomy, Kyle, because that's a big one when it comes to dementia, Alzheimer's, all the brain-related dysfunctions, the neurodegeneration that we see can easily be tied to the function or dysfunction of that glymphatic system.
Yeah, I mean, the glymphatic system is one of the major waste removal systems for this, not just the brain, but for the central nervous system. And one of the most interesting things about that system is that it is most active during sleep. So it's most active when we are in a parasympathetic mode. But how many of us are walking around regularly in a parasympathetic mode where most of us are stressed, we're anxious, we're nervous, we're depressed? And especially when we talk about a central nervous system patient population, where you add in Alzheimer's, dementia, PTSD. So their brains are literally not being cleansed every night when they go to sleep, like the rest of us, and even people like you and me. Our brains are not cleansing probably as optimally as they could with intervention, right? So yeah, we have techniques that specifically target all the sagittal or all the venous sinuses, the deep veins of the brain, and the lymphatic system of the central nervous system to improve drainage while we sleep. And more holistically, part of that, what we have to do is get people out of that high cortisol, high stress, high anxiety, sympathetic state that they're in on a daily basis too.
Yeah, and I actually just traveled to Europe recently on vacation with my family, and of course we experienced tons of jet lag, right, and on the way there, and jet lag on the way back, right. So even these sort of disruptions in sleep that come along with sort of modern life, right. A lot of people travel for work. Of course, we have even the most simple one is daylight savings time, where we change our clocks, right, which is kind of silly, and all the data shows that how unhealthy that is when we lose an hour of sleep, right. So all these micro disruptions and significant disruptions that we experience through our life are causing problems with our ability to remove waste from that brain, right, from that nervous system, central nervous system, and it's I'm hesitant to say that that is the cause of any brain dysfunction, but whenever we see neurodegeneration and any brain dysfunction show up, inevitably we are going to see dysfunction with regard to the waste clearance system of the brain. I mean, it's a highly metabolic, probably the most metabolic organ that we have is the brain, right? There's so much mitochondria, there's so much going on all the time. We need to be able to clear that system out, and of course that's why it's such an important organ to focus on.
Well, and another thing they found within the lymphatic system is infection, right? So for many years, when it came to degenerative neurologic diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia, the concept that degenerative process could be induced by infection getting up in the brain, that it didn't make any sense because how can infection get up there? There's no lymphatic system. So it wasn't until the discovery of the lymphatic system, which really wasn't all that long ago, did that become possible. So yeah, a poorly functioning lymphatic system in the central nervous system will allow for infection to stay in the brain. And there are some other kind of vascular effects that happen that follow that, that then lead to degeneration of neural tissue. And that's one thing that we see via imaging and via autopsy in people with these conditions is decreased blood volume or decreased neural volume or brain volume, right? And that's always been interesting to me, and it wasn't until recently that I understood why, or got like a great example of really why they talk about the brain in this sense of volume. And it's because our brain is in mostly water. It's mostly fluid, to the point where when cadavers, and I'm an anatomist, I do human cadaver dissection, when brains are cremated, there's no ashes. It just evaporates completely. So while the rest of the body will create these ashes that we can then gather and then return back to the families, the brains evaporated independently. The body just completely evaporated. No ash gets created at all. So yeah, in these very specific areas of the brain that are responsible for specific functions, and there's a lot of overlap there. But what they see is decreased volume of that area of the brain. And I attribute a lot of that to decreased perfusion in that area. So we have congestion on the lymphatic, venous lymphatic side that's not allowing for infection, but also biochemical markers of concussion and TBI, right? So when someone has a head injury, there are actually biochemical markers that aren't consistent enough to where they can see that. And that those biochemical markers aren't getting drained out either. They're sticking in the brain within the drainage pathways. So yeah, that drainage pathway plus the blood flow into that area If those two systems are not working together, then blood volume of, or I'm sorry, I keep saying that, then brain volume of that area will start to break down and start to decrease or atrophy just like any other part of the body.
Yeah, and this is where, on sort of the early side of brain dysfunctions, we start to see some of these common symptoms show up, whether it's the gait is a show, start to show up in a little bit of a wonky way, handwriting starts to get a little funky, right? There's memory starts to go a little bit, right? All these things start to show up, and a lot of it has to do with that reduced brain volume, with all the metabolic dysfunction, the inflammation that's starting to show up at that brain level. So again, this is where I think this is why I love counterstrain so much, is because it is irrespective of the disease label. It is irrespective of the dysfunction. It's really all about creating flow in the body and returning function to the body. And so as we close, Kyle, maybe you can just give me an example of some of the things that you've seen, patients that you've seen walk in the door with some kind of brain dysfunctions, and how counterstrain has been a part or perhaps even the sole thing that has relieved their symptoms and got them back to a more normal function.
Yeah, sure. Well, one thing I want to add to what you just said too is a lot of this like decrease in brain volume. If we can correlate the symptoms that that patient's having or the pathology that that patient is diagnosed with the veins that are responsible for draining that area of the brain and the arteries that are responsible for supplying blood to it. Then and we can restore normal perfusion around that area, and we can do some pretty amazing things. And it just depends on what area of the brain it is, right? So you're sort of talking about like motor programming, planning. So for that, generally speaking, we would target the basal ganglia, right? For someone who's in chronic pain, the PTSD, stress, anxiety, depression, we can target the limbic system, right? And the hypothalamus in these areas of the brain that correlate to being sympathetically upregulated and being in a high, elevated states of cortisol in the body. So we can target the HPA axis and things like that. So we can, it's really cool as we dive more and more into neuroanatomy, how we can very specifically target areas of the brain via perfusion.
Yeah.
So some specific, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, and kind of one of the things I'm hearing from you as you kind of get into some of the things you've seen is it sounds like the body's very responsive. The brain is very responsive. In other words, once you restore some of this function, it can come back, right? I think this is what's fascinating to me about injuries is that, seemingly some injuries or some diseases can seem like it's very difficult to recover from them, but it's in large part because we lack the sort of the healing capacity that requires that. And once that's restored, it's amazing how fast the body bounces back.
There's certainly like preventing or halting or stopping the degenerative process when it comes to some of these diseases. And I think that if we can restore the mechanisms that you're referring to, that we can do that. I think we can stop progressive degenerative conditions to a degree, and it depends on why. But and then, over time, as we restore these healing mechanisms, can we see things start to improve? And that's something that we're exploring now. And anecdotally, we do have some cases of that for sure with things like Alzheimer's and dementia, where it's slowly over months and months and months, things are starting to improve. And family members that are closest to these patients are starting to know that their gait improved and things like that. But then the other thing is wellness. Why even get there? Right. So, again, for guys like you and me in our 30s and 40s, like, why even get there? Like, let's just do the work now. Let's get this treatment now on, a quarterly basis or a monthly basis, whatever it is, so that we don't even have to worry about that stuff in our 60s, 70s, 80s, and our central nervous system is just still working optimally because we've taken care of it over the last 40 years.
Right. Yeah, totally. And that's exactly how I would approach anybody that's looking to potentially use counterstrain in their life is prophylactically, right? Preventatively, use it as a preventative measure. And also, whatever showing up in your life in terms of dysfunction, whether it's a little bit of, disrupted sleep, a little bit of pain here and there, a little bit of digestive issues, or things you're not even aware of yet, right? That can be addressed, and also longer term prevention. And I will say this, that oftentimes what I see when it comes to some kind of therapy that somebody's pursuing, sometimes that's the only therapy they're using. And still sometimes you see results, right? Like this is what's fascinating about counterstrain is that, you know, we could design a study, for example, and say, this patient population with these issues goes in and does counterstrain. Let's see the results after 6 months. Now let's take a look at those the same identical sort of group, and let's do counterstrain plus exercise plus change their diet plus improve, you know, sleep architecture, right? And we start to incorporate a more holistic approach. This is where we start to see counterstrain, I think, and the other therapies really thrive, is in the context of an improved lifestyle all around, right? And maybe some supplementation, right? There's so many things that we can do. And again, this is where no matter whether it's acupuncture or counterstrain or chiropractic or whatever the technique and therapeutic tool is, if we can use that in a context of improving the entire picture, right? And this is where I think Dale Bredesen's done such a great job, is a comprehensive approach to things like dementia and Alzheimer's. Now we throw something like counterstrain on top of that. I mean, this is where I think the results are even more profound, and we get there quicker, and we start to see these slow changes start to move really quick, and we can get, I think, a little bit farther than we otherwise thought, right? This is, again, it's because the ability of counterstrain, I think, uniquely to open up the systems, to get things flowing, and to allow the body to sort of return to a more optimal state of harmony.
Right. So I'll tell you about probably one of my kind of favorite patients.
I thought it was me.
Well, in the central nervous system world. I'll tell you about him, but then I also want to tell you about an ongoing research project that basically has done exactly what you just kind of talked about. And they're doing some amazing work too. So I definitely want to talk about them, especially with the patient population that they're specifically targeting. But my patient was a collegiate wrestler, high school wrestler, wrestled at Iowa State. So, you know, big time,
big school,
big time wrestling, and just had a history of concussions going back to probably middle school. Right. He was a one time training at like the Olympic facility. So he was a high level guy, lots of concussions. And then eventually had to medically retire because he got to a point where if he got bumped, he'd get a concussion. Like his tolerance to a mechanical trauma at that point was just so low. He started getting into coaching, and I worked with both him and his girlfriend. And in working with them initially, he had all the basic signs of post-concussion, post kind of TBI, right? So like light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, cognitive function sensitivity, right? Like if you questioned him too much when he was in a slightly stressful state, he'd quickly elevate to this kind of agitated, angry state. And that created some behavioral things that, you know, from an outside perspective, you'd be like, this guy's crazy. Or, you know, if you were a family member of his girlfriend, you'd be like, you got to get away from this guy. But it's really just the state of his brain and then the ability of his brain to function in this post-concussion, you know, post-multiple concussion state. But one of the most telling things that he told me was he was running an errand and he knew he had to go get deodorant from the drugstore, right? But he was sitting in his car outside at the drugstore in the parking lot, and there was like the drugstore on his left and like Men's Warehouse on the right. And he just was sitting in his car for hours, he said. He said, I sat there for hours. I could not figure out what store I needed to go into. So the functioning process of his brain, like that, you know, decision making, reward, cognitive function, like not, they just were frozen. Wow. And he just sat in his car for hours, being unable to make a decision. So that's probably one of the more like low level. I have seen some other like encephalitis patients who have described very similar symptoms. But I've worked with him over a couple of years now. I see him intermittently, but he's responded dramatically. And he's actually back to doing some wrestling. I have to almost kind of slow him down a lot of times and be like, you know, in his training, he'll train with his athletes. And he'll get his head knocked every now and then. And he immediately comes in and he's like, yeah, I did it again. But we can kind of clean him up real quick. But he doesn't go into full-blown concussion mode anymore with trauma. Light sensitivity gone. noise sensitivity gone. He's a happier person. His girlfriend describes like large personality changes. And then the cognitive, higher level cognitive function stuff that he was describing before is gone. So into working with him, what we targeted again was sympathetic nervous system, decreasing that elevated sympathetic state, and then restoring perfusion to the brain. And then I see him again here in a little bit. One thing I'm kind of currently exploring too is being able to treat the axon bundles that actually travel through the central nervous system as well. So that's a cool thing that I'm playing around with a little bit as well. But the other thing I wanted to mention is there is a group in based out of Washington. One of my colleagues, her name is Holly Christie. She's a naturopathic doctor. But her and two of her colleagues are conducting a research study. It's called the Bridgeback Project, where they're working with first responders and military veterans who are experiencing PTSD. And they've developed a fascial counterstrain protocol for how to intervene with these patients. They intervene with them for a series of visits to complete that protocol. And their early findings are remarkable with how quickly they're getting these patients to one, pass psychological examination and to move from this diagnosis of PTSD to no longer having PTSD, but also to return to work and to return to normal function in society. So this whole concept of us being able to mechanically intervene on the central nervous system and at least to this point, anecdotally see symptomatic change, they're doing an amazing job at researching that and giving us some evidence that what we're doing anecdotally, we can verify with research too. So,
wow. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. And counterstrain has been around for a few decades, but it's still fairly young in its, I guess, expression, right? You guys are still learning a lot. You're still experimenting a lot. The cool part is that you can experiment and play around with this technique in a way that is non-destructive. It doesn't cause a lot of harm. I mean, that's what's really profound about it. I mean, it's either you're probably just going to stumble and not find anything or it's not going to work, or it's going to work. And you're going to figure out, okay, what was that? How did that work? What's happening here? How can I, you know, duplicate this? What can I learn, right? And because it's an experiential technique, you're actually learning every time you do this, right? So I have no doubt that in 10, 20 years, this is going to be a technique that so many people have heard of. It's going to be in a different place than it is now in terms of its availability and just your guys' understanding. I mean, it's truly amazing. And again, I think it's worth stating once again that this is a technique and a therapy that can stand alone on its own and provide tremendous relief, not just of symptoms, but of actual function and dysfunction that's going on in the body. And when we throw it on top of a program, of a comprehensive approach at dealing with any kind of disease symptomology, it's really, really remarkable. It enhances anything that you're doing already, right? And so for anybody that's dealing with symptoms, anybody that wants to prevent any kind of dysfunction and disease, this is a technique that I have to recommend. And it's why I love bringing you on, and love talking to you, and I love coming to see you. And it's because it, every time I go in there, I get something out of it, right? I mean, not only am I preventing things long-term, but it's like I can actually tell that you've created a positive change just after that one visit, right? So it's truly remarkable. Kyle, where can people find more about counterstrain if they're in different parts of the US or the world? How can they find a practitioner perhaps?
Yeah, if you're a prospective patient and you're looking for a practitioner, there's two online databases right now. There's jicounterstrain.com, which is the Jones Institute website. And on that website, we have a student directory where patients can go in and plug in their zip code or their home address. And then it'll auto-populate a search with kind of the closest practitioners in your area. And then there's also counterstrain.com. And there's a practitioner lookup there where, again, you plug in your home address or zip code and it'll auto-populate. Certainly with this kind of higher level central nervous system work, I'd recommend just looking for students of counterstrain that have taken a lot of courses, kind of specifically up into like the central nervous system or the Nerve 1, Nerve 2 courses that we offer. So those would be the two places to find somebody, to find a practitioner. And then if you're a practitioner out there looking for training, we offer our entry-level course into this fascial counterstring curriculum. It's called the Fascial Counterstring Fascial Foundations course. And that course is taught 3 to 4 times a year. We have one coming up in November, later this year, in 2022. And registration for that course you can find on the Jones Institute at jicounterstrain.com.
Beautiful. Kyle, and if you're in San Diego too, you can go to Counterstrain SD, right? At counterstrainsd.com to find Kyle.
CounterstrainSD.com. That's my website. Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, Kyle, thanks so much for coming on. And again, I'll see you in a couple of weeks and you can work your magic. It's been a pleasure.
Sounds good.